just a pleasure to welcome back Bob Hoy, formerly of Institutional Advisors and now the editor-in-chief, investment strategist of chartsandmarkets.com. I bet you didn't think I'd remember that, Bob Hoy.
You got it down. We changed the name of the business.
Exactly. And you were saying the weather more delightful today.
How about 71 degrees, no breeze? Now, I'm only about 1,000 feet away from the ocean, so I look down into the called Georgia Strait and then across the strait, the mountains on Vancouver Island. So, and actually, on the edge of the cliff going down the ocean, there's some very tall old fir trees, and one of them is blasted out on the top, and it's got little stubbed branches. And oftentimes there'll be two eagles perched there, but this morning there's just one. But everything's great.
Well, I can't say that our view here from this home in North Carolina is nearly as breathtaking, but, you know, we do have seasonal, nearly 300-degree panoramic views of the Blue Ridge Mountains.
Through the city, we've got urban coyotes, urban raccoons.
Mm-hmm.
We've got urban skunks. We have urban socialists.
We have another rare breed, the urban possum. Moving on here to the topic du jour, the potential inversion, the flattening of the yield curve. Today, the yield curve is the flattest it has been in 11 years. This according to Michael Schneider, and he does a great job trying to bring to the attention of North Americans the significance of the yield curve, because most people, their eyes will gloss over if you bring up this idea of the three-month note and two-year note and the five and the 10-year bills. The yield curve is perhaps one of the most important indicators of a recession. It's predicted every single recession since the 1960s.
Got the yield curve back to 1857.
Well, there you go. Our current Fed chief, Jerome Powell, is disinterested in the yield curve. The flattest the yield curve has been in over a decade. And what that means is by the end of this year, or perhaps early 2019, we could get that dreaded inversion. Tell people the significance of this for the markets, please.
Yeah, well, what it is short rates get bid up faster than long rates because there's a speculative demand for short-term stuff, you know, leverage, margin at the brokerage, and the equivalent everywhere. It's as old as the hills. Now, the thing about central banking is that when the yield curve gets pushed enough and reverses, there's nothing the senior central bank can do about it. So the issue is not flattening, which it has been doing. It's when it changes, and that's the problem. Now, the other thing that goes with that, Chris, is that short rates go up, like T-bills, and they've risen to a little over 2% from next to nothing on the three-month. The typical type of commentator out there who says, oh, rising interest rates, awful. Short rates going up and the curve flattening confirms that the boom is on. And so long as it's on, it's on. But now, in 2007, we looked at it, and in late 2006 it was, I think, it briefly actually inverted. We're looking at the fives to the 30s. And then it spent most of the time, like 20 beeps under. And this is where it's been recently, come into about 19, 20 basis points from inversion. Now, also with our chart going back to 1857 on the yield curve, there are times when you went into a bear market and recession when the curve didn't fully invert. So inversion's not necessary. The key is the change in direction. Now, maybe last week the flattening, and it's now coming back a bit, but on this one we expect that the bank stocks would benefit in the first of turning to steepening, but the event of turning to steepening is a very good indicator of going into the contraction. And then the credit markets, the other one that is good too is the credit spreads, which is the difference between high-grade bonds and low-grade bonds, and then in a period of confidence that you have with a boom, everybody's reaching for yield and overlooking risk, and the spreads have narrowed until about 5 or 6 weeks ago when they've made an attempt to reverse. Now, technically, this is not reversed yet, but it's done what we call the first breakout on an attempt to turn to widening. And in the past, like 2007 or 2000, it was the second attempt to widening that really became critical. And in 2007, that was accomplished by late August, and then the high in the stock market on the S&P was the middle of October. So we're watching it closely, and the beauty of it, Chris, is that the Federal Reserve can do nothing about it because it's a change by the public from the demand for speculative money. And when that changes, it shows that speculators are changing themselves, and it can be a subtle change. And then, as we know, the Austrian school is headed up by von Mises has said a very simple one, and that is that at the top of a boom for the contraction, the bankers don't have to call in the loans. All they do is get a bit nervous and stop making them. So here we are, watching for the curve and the credit spreads to change direction. And you can't make a decision on it till they actually have accomplished the change, but we're in the period when they could likely change. You remember earlier in the year, Chris, we were talking about sunshine in the credit markets, and the sunshine could run into about June, which it has done. And then we had some fun with the play on words and get into twilight in August, and then the full twilight zone in the fall where you could we could face a liquidity crisis. Take a look at it from an investor's point of view, owning investment-grade stocks, and he thinks he's safe. But the problem is that speculators have bid these things up to speculative highs, and you can talk about price earnings multiples, but stock analysts are there to come up with a forecast on earnings that'll rationalize the urge to buy stock at high prices. And so the one we look at is the S&P relative to wages, the average wage, and it's exceptionally high, or was at the turn of the year. And another one that's good is relative to the GDP. Because, you know, again, the economists can come out with changes in GDP forecasts, but it's pretty real. And then another one you look at is the ratio between growth stocks and investment stocks. Well, that then one is up to as high as it was in 2007. So a few ways of looking at it rationally say that the market is overpriced, similar to what it was in 2007 as the last instance. Again, we use our tried and true methods. The other one that was part of the sunshine, Chris, that was helpful coming out of the hit at the first of the year was that we expected industrial commodities like base metals and lumber, crude oil, to rally out to around May, and they did, and they've been hit hard. So that's a big warning, particularly copper has taken quite a drop. So that was the other one. So altogether, we called these, beyond using the term sunshine, we called them friends of the bull market. And the only two friends left are in the credit markets where you still got short rates going up. And as I said, the curve is still flattening and spreads, well, they have widened for or have narrowed for a bit. But anyways, they are not as yet negative, but the base metals and industrial commodities, they are very negative. So, and then the other thing on these industrial commodities is you can often have a good low for lumber in October of the year, copper often a low in November, and crude oil often a low in November, December. So you're looking at seasonal lows. And the other ones I looked at, you know, the exotics, like cobalt and lithium, they are now in bear markets. And I took a look at vanadium, and it's sort of toppy, I guess, but maybe we have to look some work on that one. But as I said, the exotics have headed south as well. So you have to really look at what these basics are telling us. And then you kind of get, whereas if you listen to the economists or the central bankers, or what I'm hoping to see is that I think, without measuring, I think there's more talk about the yield curve now than at any time that I can recall. So people are looking at it. Now, the other thing is that some of the big brokerage firms are a little more astute than they used to be, when actually research was dominated by the underwriting department, and all they wanted was good write-ups on the stock that they'd underwritten. So the big brokers have moved a little more sophisticated, but you can take a look at one of their 30-page studies on one thing, and what a waste of time. Whereas what we do is, in four pages, cover the key things on whether you're going to make money in the bond market, or you're going to make money in commodities, or you're going to make money in stocks. And been doing it for decades, and it works for us, and it works for our subscribers.
Well, wouldn't the medieval monk Occam be impressed?
Occam's razor, yeah. He was an Oxford man, and was one of the highlight intellectuals in a period within the church when scholasticism was a problem. And these guys were very clever, very bright men, and they debated all sorts of theological things forever. That was their job. But you had standouts like Occam, who really rose above it. And outside of the church, was, of course, with Copernicus. And then eventually you had Kepler. Occam was back in the 1300s, I think. And then you had
Johannes Kepler.
You know, he was the leading mind who figured out the orbits, that they were elliptical.
Yes, he did. But he did it mathematically, too, which was interesting.
Guess what? At the time, the government wanted to hear his forecasts based upon astrology. So solving the orbits of the solar system was fantastic, but what government wanted was some forecasts on what they were doing based on astrology.
Don't forget Tycho Brahe, the meticulous note-taking, his empirical observations that he drew from the constellations and the heavens that actually facilitated the mathematical theories of Kepler. You noted that it was government and the needs that they had that drove much of the great scientific breakthroughs. Well, take a look at Galileo Galilei. He, of course, at the time sold his refracting telescope to the government so that they could look for ships on the horizon several hours ahead of their arrival and protect the country or the city-state from invading forces. If you were, let's say, a bondholder or a shareholder of a particular company on a particular route, and you could see that your ships were arriving several hours ahead of the other people at the exchanges, that gave you a great advantage as well. And I like how Occam's razor can cut out the hyperbole and get us just to the facts. I'd like to return, though, to this concept of the yield curve and just how significant it is, because I want all of our listeners, even those who are new to the show, to get a really solid feel for the significance of the yield curve, but on a very basic level. So banks borrow in the short term. This makes sense. And then they lend to people, for, let's say, for a mortgage or a business loan, anywhere from 10, 20, 30 years or more. So they profit from the difference between them, because the longer the loan you have, the higher the interest rate, because there's more volatility and there are many unknowns in the future. So it just increases the yield. Whereas the shorter term, we have a better feel for what's coming down the pike, that you have lower rates in general. You know, as long as that gap between long and short is relatively significant, it predicts the profitability of the financial institutions and their ability to remain solvent on their obligations. However, as that gap starts to narrow, as we're seeing the most narrow yield in over 10 years, and this, of course, is the proxy that the Fed looks at and the other banking institutions, profitability begins on average to decline significantly. And then when you have an inversion, it can become much more challenging for financial institutions. And keep in mind that the financial institutions tend to lead the economy, usually a leading indicator, at least of the stock market. So why don't we run with this idea, and you can help people understand the significance of this lending proxy and why everyone needs to keep an eye on it.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's called borrowing short and lending long. And they've been doing it for hundreds and hundreds of years. And even, say, example, in the 1720 South Sea bubble, you could borrow from the senior, well, the Bank of England then at 5%, and you could get the equivalent of 20% on call, and the equivalent of a call market. So it gets very compelling. And then the 1825 bubble, there's a note, it just the arithmetic of borrowing short and lending long is so compelling. And then everybody plays it to the hilt, and then it goes the other way. So what happens in a bubble is everything gets speculated. And when the curve reverses and is matched by credit spreads widening, that the senior central bank, although it poses as being in charge by raising short rates, it's just following market rates of interest, and it will eventually. So the irony is that the Fed really thinks it's running things, and when the Fed was formed and first opened the doors in January of 1914, the theme then was that the Fed would prevent nasty setbacks in the financial markets that always preceded recessions. Great theory, but there's been 18 recessions since the Fed opened its doors in 1914. So the theory's there, but it never works. And here we are again, a classic spreads flattening and the curve narrowing, and there's nothing that the Fed can do about it. And we would remind people of that seasonally, we're in the time of year when these credit markets can change. So we watch them very closely.
I think the key takeaway point here, you can ignore all the rest, forget all the terms. As we start to see this unfold, and we expect it to continue, almost all of our top guests here agree with us that we're going to see this become a more and more mainstream concept in the next 6 to 12 months. What people need to keep in mind is it is just becoming more and more expensive for businesses and institutions to lend. And as that lending becomes curtailed, businesses find it difficult to expand. When it's harder to expand and meet obligations, you see increases in layoffs, slowed production, start to see increases in unemployment, you start to see declines in corporate profits. Add this all up and you have lower economic output and quite possibly a significant decline in interest in U.S. shares. But we're also seeing a flattening of the yield curve in Japan, as well as Europe and around the world, because we're so interconnected, I'd say more so than ever before.
The credit markets are global. What you have here is that the Fed has never prevented the reversal in these credit markets that sets off a contraction. Now, the other thing that in old days, before we got into this world of financial inflation and financial assets, the stock market would go up and get overbought and head down. But the economy would be still generating good news, because often a peak in the stock market would be about 12 months ahead of the peak in the economy. But when you're in a world of inflation and financial assets, the changes are virtually together. Like, for example, the stock market peaked in October 2007, and then the NBER decided that the recession started that December. And then if you go back to 1929, the stock market peaked in that fateful September, and the NBER decided that the economy peaked in that August. And then there's one more great financial bubble that was covered by the recession work that done by the NBER, and that was the bubble of 1873, which in New York peaked in, guess what, September. And that recession started in that October. And then by 1884, senior economists in England looked at how relentless the contraction was and said, and started calling it the Great Depression. And that Great Depression ran from 1873 to 1896. And then you had senior economists in England again. Rothstel was one of them, as late as 1939, was still analyzing the Great Depression of 1873 to 1895 and how it could have been prevented when they're in the midst of then the Great Depression that started in 1929. So the world of financial asset inflation is very different from normal times, and we are in a world of financial asset inflation. And when it turns down, the economy quite likely will head south instantly with it, as it did in 2007. So we live in very interesting times.
One little proviso, though. Take a look at 2007, 2008. I mean, it was obvious that a housing collapse was coming. At the time, my former mentor, Bob Chapman, and I, we were just pounding the table more than I think any other pundit. As CNBC was convinced it was the best housing market buying opportunity in decades, when we were just off less than 2 or 3% from the peak Case-Shiller index, we were saying this is going to be a wholesale rout like we've never seen before. And then the very next day, Ben Bernanke, the chairman, Fed chairman at the time, actually made a call, I think, on CNBC to Maria Bartiromo, if memory serves. He said something to the effect of, I don't buy your premise. There has never been a housing collapse. His comments echo in infamy, you know, today.
He didn't know what happened to real estate in the U.S. after 1928.
If you study history, financial and economic history, Jesse Livermore was actually speculating in the Florida housing bubble at that time.
On property values in a depression, the only one I could find back away was in England in 1873, and I came across a chart of farmland values. And it peaked with the bubble in 1873 on, you know, annual average numbers, and went all the way down to the end of the Depression in 1896. Not one year did it even go sideways. So farmland values in that Great Depression went down, and quite likely most values for property in the next contraction will go down.
I have some excellent contacts at the major financial publisher, John Wiley & Sons, the editor, directors, and all the contacts there.
Good way of going about it. I know there's a book here, and all I have to do is get it out. And that then takes a special effort, which I should do. I had wanted to actually to have published one a few years ago, but the pressures of business and writing weekly. But you're right, to take a certain amount of time each day and work on a chapter.
Even if it's just 15 minutes, put it aside from your newsletter work and all the rest. If you ever want to read a book that I think you could mirror, it was really Bernstein's classic, Against the Gods. Anyone who loves financial history must pick up Bernstein's Against the Gods. And he brings so many fascinating anecdotes from history. Why don't you give us an overview of what this inverted yield curve plus the nascent trade war that we're seeing unfold? Could this sort of converge into a perfect financial storm?
Yeah, it can, Christy. But first of all, Trump is trying to ease the protectionism that has existed for a long time against the United States. And remember, I'm saying this from Canada, but in every post-bubble contraction, a turn has been that in each country, each government is facing unemployment and hardship, and they do the natural, which is protectionism, because they got to look after their own electorate. So there will be, now, the best one for a name followed the 1825 bubble, and the U.S. came in with what was called the Tariff of Abominations. So how bad is that going to be? And it'll happen. It's the way it works. Each politician domestically has to look after unemployment, and there will be economists who will say, go to protectionism. But at the moment, Trump is not moving to protectionism. He's trying to reduce it against the U.S., and I back him on that. So
I'd like for you to give our listeners today an idea of just how these series of events might impact U.S. shares, the precious metals, and even the not-so-precious metals, commodities, for instance. Crude oil, which is an interesting rogue element showing its own signs of life between the CRB, the Commodities Index, and crude oil lately. And then the U.S. dollar, which is acting peculiarly as well.
bubble where we have been. Industrial commodities in real terms deflated go up. They're not going up anymore. And in the same bubble, the real price of gold deflated by the CPI goes down. It did. It declined from 2011 to 2017, and it's been going flat since. And in the contraction, this reverses where real prices of base metals go down for a long time, and the real price of gold goes up for an equally long time, making the industry very profitable. So every Great Depression, the leading industry that you can analyze has been gold mining. And the way it works, Chris, is that in a bubble, you have a huge expansion of credit that can't be serviced, and you have also a huge expansion of fanciful credit, you know, all kinds of derivatives and imaginary stuff. Well, all of that contracts, and as the real price of gold goes up, that's the way Mother Nature begins to reliquify the system. The real price goes up, producers produce more of it, it goes into the banking system and starts to restore liquidity. And so the irony has been, is that I mentioned about the Great Depression that ended in the late 1890s, and that was then at the end of a 20-year bull market for gold's real price and a long period of high unemployment. So what do you get? Gold, very attractive, and a whole lot of unemployed men going looking for it. So every great gold rush has occurred close to the bottom of a Great Depression. That was the case in California in the 1840s as well. That was a Great Depression bottom. So here's the theme. Most stock sectors down, including gold stocks, and then out of the storm, you'll end up with a long bull market for the gold sector, and it eventually will become highly speculative and a lot of fun. Junior mines moving, the whole thing. But that's ahead of us, and the entry is going to be difficult, and this is where you want to have a subscription to a service that knows what's going on.
It's interesting you'd mention that, because if you look at the bottom of the U.S. equities mini crash, I guess, of the year 2000 down to 2002, 2003, that was really the genesis, I think you'd agree, of the 12-year gold bull market. Coincides almost perfectly with your idea that the bull markets in the precious metals tend to follow carnage and chaos in U.S. equities and in the economy as a whole. And tell us a little bit more about charts and markets, what people can find.
Find just chartsandmarkets.com or just me, bobhoy.com, and that'll take you straight into the site. And we've got some very good charts in the history there, plus explanations. And we can, each week's main piece covers the key items. We'll enjoy people checking out our service. Okay, Chris, next time. Yep.
Talk soon. Bye-bye.